In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, May 10th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it is Alan Schfotken of the Professional Services Council. It's great to see you, my friend.
Always a pleasure to be here, Francis.
And John Desenberg of the Performance Institute. Also great to have you on the program again.
Great to be here.
Thank you for coming in today. We have selections that each of you have made. We're going to post them later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth so you can listen along as we start out where we always do with...
Number three!
John Desenberg, your third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec, and it sounds like maybe a little bit of crying. The headline is, Bring Federal Conferences Back to Las Vegas, lawmakers say. And, of course, these are members from Nevada.
Of course.
And they want that money back where back in the home state where it used to, a lot of it used to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, I brought this up for a couple of reasons. And number one, the Performance Institute, we're an events business, so I have some personal familiarity with this. And let me just give you some of the facts, Francis, which is hotel rooms, a standard hotel room in Las Vegas is $40 to $60 sometimes for these events. And I have firsthand knowledge on that. The standard room here in the Washington area, $250 to $300. Food, the same thing. Air flights, the same thing. Much cheaper for most of the country to get to Las Vegas. So, you know, I'm not in support of these people. Obviously, they have their own personal agenda. But the point is, the what they call the optics on this issue clouded people's perception in such a dramatic way. And we're not just talking about a little bit of a price difference. We're talking about a large price difference between Washington, D.C. and Las Vegas. And by the way, there are a lot of federal employees and other government employees who live and work in the western part of this country. And this is just became kind of a political pinata. You know, people could say, oh, Las Vegas, there's casinos there. Well, you know what? The federal events, they were not giving people chips. This was not a way to promote gambling. In some ways, this was an efficient place to have meetings. Las Vegas is a city designed to do this at a very low price. That's the really their big industry, whereas Washington, D.C. is a very expensive place. And I'm not defending abuses that went on. As they say, there were some bad eggs, et cetera. But let me tell you the other reason I wanted to bring up this story. It's not just about dollars and cents. It's about leadership. We've had the chance at the Performance Institute to recently be over at the Department of Veterans Administration, mm-hmm. Veterans Affairs. They had their conference issues. What I find interesting about that situation from last fall was upon doing some investigation and speaking to people over there, these are people who volunteered. Some of these folks volunteered to help with an event or conferences, and then were promptly thrown under the bus by their leadership on some of these issues. Mm. And so I just find this whole business of Travelgate and conferences, it shows, number one, that we're not always tracking data and using, you know, real evidence and real information. We often use, you know, what looks bad as a substitute for what really is bad. Number two, I find the lack of leadership and the lack of leadership stepping up and taking responsibility for mistakes mm-hmm. sometimes to be troubling. Why would you throw someone who volunteered to help on an event under the bus? And if you read the quotes from last fall at VA, for instance, what you'll see is a quote like this. I told my employee to check with lawyers. That's not an excuse. You are still accountable, leadership. Mm-hmm. If you didn't believe this event should take place, it was your responsibility to stop the event. It's not an excuse to say, I told them to check with lawyers.
That's an interesting piece of information about the VA thing, too, because when I think back to the General Services Administration conference issue that cited in this story, one of the places that they took heat from members of Congress was, hey, you hired out to have a conference company plan this for you when you have people on staff that do this. So yes, there's a duplication issue, but one of the implications was you shouldn't be hiring people. You should have people on staff that can do this for you. There, it was staff people who did it and didn't do it to the level that somebody else in the organization thought was right. So it's kind of
one last comment on this. If someone did something really wrong, fire them, tell them to please leave, pack up their things and go. Don't let them stay in a similar job, keep their salary, and just have them, you know, have kind of their name smeared in the press. I just that's not acceptable.
John Desenberg's third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is "Bring Federal Conferences Back to Las Vegas," lawmakers say. Alan Shvatkin, your third most important story of the week is from the Federal Times. The headline is "Sequester Changes Rules on DoD Contractor Background Reinvestigations," and this is one of these unintended consequences stories, I thought, when I first looked at this.
Well, that's right. I selected it for a couple of reasons. First, it has my favorite word of sequestration in the title, so that was good. Secondly, it addresses not only the direct implications of the austerity and the cost reductions, but it raises the significant collateral effects of some of the decisions and maybe the unintended consequences without really thinking through them. So in this whole area of security clearances, you've covered it a lot. The government has actually made good progress in reducing the backlog, in accelerating the background investigations, and making the adjudications. In fact, we at the Professional Services Council have had a mantra in this area. We call it the four ones. One application, one investigation, one adjudication, and one clearance. We've made good progress on three of the four, not on the reciprocity issues. And now I wonder that might be at some risk if these periodic reinvestigations, these are conducted for people who have already gotten a security clearance, but you want to make sure periodically that there's nothing changed in their background, whether we're going to slip and fall off the wagon a little bit as we slip because of financial reasons.
The story says that the Defense Security Service says it will now accept these reinvestigation requests from industry only 30 days before the anniversary of a person's clearance investigation anniversary date. Previously, people had 90 days to submit a request. Is that going to be enough turnaround time?
Well,
because it sounds, I guess the question is, to what degree do they do a reinvestigation? How does that compare to the original investigation? Because you can't do one of those in 90 days.
You can't do an original investigation in 90, and they can't really do the periodic reinvestigation in the 30 days either. All this does in this fiscal year is to slip the funding into the next calendar, the next federal fiscal year. And so I think there's other ways to manage the financial relationships of these issues in the discussion between federal agencies and the Office of Personnel Management that conducts these. But I think we're going to see the security clearance issue and the backlog raise again simply because of short-term decisions. And this is just another example of where short-term decisions are going to have long-term implications.
All right, I'm going to put you in a spot because I understand the nature of unintended consequences. You don't see them till they happen. But do you anticipate any others in particular on the horizon because of sequestration? Things like this that I don't think anybody saw that coming necessarily.
No, we didn't, and it's hard to guess. I'm thinking that in the areas of overhaul and maintenance, the deferral of maintenance, things are going to break because instead of changing the oil in the car every 5,000 or 6,000 miles, people will wait until 8,000 miles, or they'll wait until 10, or they'll forget for a while, instead of doing changing the filters or whatever those routine household maintenance that you and I would do normally, or somebody would do normally, might not.
You'd send out and have it done, I'm sure.
Then I'd go to experts on even changing filters.
That's a great way to put it, though. I love that. I'm going to use that, in fact.
You can come over to my house and test it out if you'd like to.
I don't think that will happen.
Those are the kinds of things that short-term decisions are going to have long-term implications. Stuff that is easily maintainable, you now have to repair or replace. And the cost of that are significantly higher.
Alan Shvatkin's third most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown this week is Sequester Changes Rules on DoD Contractor Background Reinvestigations. It's from the Federal Times, and you can read it and all of our Countdown stories later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The number two most important federal news stories of the week from Alan Shvatkin and John Desenberg when we continue on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Beyond is born. brought to you by EADS North America.
This is J.J. Green. The U.S. Army is the main branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. The highest-ranking officer is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The regular Army has 562,000 soldiers. The Army National Guard has 362,000, and the U.S. Army Reserve has 205,000, putting the combined component strength at 1.1 million soldiers. If you have a story about the Army you'd like to share, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com.
We see the hiker. He appears injured.
Every day, the Army and National Guard take to the skies in their newest helicopter, the UH-72A Lakota from EADS North America. Whether from medical evacuation, search and rescue, or emergency response, the Lakota ensures our armed forces complete the mission.
Hiker is secure.
And every Lakota has been delivered on time and on budget.
ETA, 30 minutes.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Stop me if you've heard this one. A woman with a serious case of the sniffles goes to see her doctor. She leaves with a mammogram, an eye exam, diabetic screening, and prescription for that sniffling nose. No, we have. See, at Kaiser Permanente, our system uses the latest technology to set a new standard of connected care. So when you visit your doctor, your care team will have access to your medical history. They can see if you need to make any appointments, fill prescriptions, or if you're overdue for any potential life-saving screenings, like a mammogram. Then they can instantly schedule one, often in the same day at the same facility. This advanced model of care has helped us achieve the highest mammogram screening rate in the nation. Okay, now stop me if you've heard this one. A member walks into a Kaiser Permanente facility. The entire staff works together to make sure that they live well, be well, and thrive. Pretty sure you've heard that one before. Not a member yet? Learn more at kp.org/midatlantic. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated. 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
This is Aileen Black, Vice President of VMware Federal. With all the talk about cloud computing in the federal community, one has got to wonder, whose cloud are we really talking about? Cloud computing is changing the way IT resources are delivered, managed, and consumed. No small deal. As agencies seek agility, cost savings, security, and flexibility, the last thing you need is to get locked into a one-size-fits-all model that forces dependence on something you can't control. More federal IT infrastructure is virtualized on VMware than any other platform, because virtualization is the foundation for cloud computing. Our solutions aren't just complete, they're completely flexible, so you can build the most important cloud in the world, your cloud.
The Federal News Radio CXO Survey 2013 Priorities, underwritten by VMware and Carahsoft, provides insight into CIO's top priorities in 2013, cloud, mobile, big data, and the changing landscape of budgets. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword survey, to see the results.
I'm Emily Kopp. On Monday's Federal Drive, we're live at the Excellence in Government Conference in downtown Washington. We'll learn how agencies can do their best on lighter wallets. And defense analyst Guy Stitt dissects the Navy's strategy for coping with its budget cuts. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It's the Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Desenberg of the Performance Institute and Alan Schvatkin of the Professional Services Council. And we're at
number two.
Alan, your second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is "Most Top Contractors Increased Business with Federal Government in 2012." And these are numbers that you could read a number of different ways, like most numbers and surveys and so on. What did you see when you looked at the numbers? Good news, bad news, or just news?
Well, it, like everything else, Francis, there are two sides to this coin. The first is the disappointment in a greater consolidation among the top contractors, that even as spending has declined over the past three or four federal fiscal years in the purchase of all goods and services, and particularly in the purchase of services that we look at more carefully at the Professional Services Council, we're seeing an increase in business being won by the usual suspects. Now, many of those usual suspects are members, and so I'm very happy to see them succeed. But we're not doing much to broaden the base. giving the opportunities for small and mid-tier firms to come into the marketplace. And so the related issue about how we're seeing a decline in awards and the leads me to concerns about consolidation in the marketplace, the barriers to entry of new firms, and how we're really not shifting to open up the marketplace. We're contracting and buying from the same people in the same way as the government has bought historically. That makes it in the large IDIQ contracts, large multiple award contracts, it takes some size in order to compete in that marketplace.
One of the things, this data comes from analysis by Bloomberg Government, and we had Nick Toborek of Bloomberg on talking about this earlier in the week. One of the things that I thought of after I talked to him, and so I'm happy to have this opportunity to go over this again with you, Alan, is I was reminded by this data and the fact that you're pointing out that Center for Strategic International Studies did an analysis of defense contracting, and they went back 10 years. And if you account for the mergers and acquisitions in that period of time, it over a 10-year period, this is only in the defense space. But the numbers, the trend is pretty much the same there, too.
The trend is very similar.
The players don't really change that much except when they decide to change through an M&A.
I won't get the number precisely right, but we looked at some of that data ourselves. And in fact, we did some work in conjunction with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in the study of the services sector. If you look back 10 or 15 years ago, the market has changed significantly, both in size and characterization. But the top 20 companies had 42%, 48% of the market then. They have that now. In 10 years ago, the top 20th company had $250 million worth of business. Today, it's about $1 billion. Mm-hmm. So market value has changed, but the configuration,
even the share distribution hasn't really changed a whole lot.
Significantly at the top.
Yeah. John, is this something to worry about, given the fact that the distributions seem to be the same and the overall health of the market seems to be the same? I mean, those trends seem to be continuing. So is there something to be worried about here?
There's two things that I'd like to bring up here. Number one, with the constant drumbeat on small business, disadvantaged business, I think one of the things that we need to talk about, we all know it's the elephant in the room, is a bit of a gaming of the system. People partner with a disadvantaged firm, a large giant firm, partnering with a disadvantaged firm in order to get in under that rubric. I mean, there are some issues out there, and obviously, you know, Alan's the expert. I am not.
To be fair, let's not crack on the huge companies either. It takes two to tango in an environment that. There has to be a small company that's willing to do that kind of a partnership.
I'll tell you what concerns me from a firsthand perspective and what I see as a think tank out there and doing training on issues. I find often that instead of training government officials and staff on performance issues, I find myself training low-level contractors, 21, 22-year-old contractors from big firms who are being brought into agencies without a high level of knowledge or experience or sophistication on issues. That leads me to think, why are we training contractors on the government's dollar and on government time? This is a concern to me that you do have a lot of young, inexperienced staff brought in by these mega firms to staff positions. I think we've all seen it out there in government agencies. It's just a question mark for me. What's going on?
Well, the access to talent is a significant issue. And, your sources of talent are what you bring to the table, what you attract from government agencies, and many of those are in the experienced range, and what you're going to attract from the competitively in the private sector marketplace. So lots of issues. The other piece I wanted to highlight here is the growth in new areas, health IT, cybersecurity. Some of those requirements really do look at new work that we haven't had in the last decade. And so not to be overly wild that while the big are just getting bigger, I mean, the government is actually changing some of the mission responsibilities, and new work is coming out in areas that they've never contracted before.
But if you wanted to stereotype a lot of that, the way the market at least looks from the outside, Alan, you would say, okay, company X, who historically has done the kinds of things government needed before, if they can't develop their expertise to meet, say, health IT, they're just going to go out and buy a company that's good at health IT that has the technology in-house already. And that's how they're going to get big there, and then they're going to wind up again on this on the top 20 list next
Absolutely.
Year.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that's bad necessarily.
It's just a market strategy.
That's right. It's one way of approaching the market, and the innovation is apparently still happening because this smaller company was doing something valuable enough that a big company wanted to buy them.
Right. And we see that. Well, M&A transactions have been down a little bit. It's still ongoing. There's still a lot of those transactions. And we know, I know from my own personal experience, I remember companies tell us it's just easier to go the M&A route than it is to grow organically.
Well, especially as cheap as money is right now.
As it is. And the security clearances and everything else like that all become barriers to new entrants.
Alan Zhvatkin's second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline, most top contractors increased business with federal government in 2012. And you can find it and all the stories on the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Later this afternoon, John Desenberg's second most important federal news story of the week next when we continue the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
This facial recognition and lack of privacy is going to be a problem on an ongoing basis. Now, coming up in the future, you're going to see face recognition technology on ATMs, which actually is a pretty good
idea. That's a great idea.
I love that idea. They're also going to have face recognition software on mobile devices. So the device is going to look at your face, and instead of you putting in a code to unlock it, if it doesn't see you, it's not going to unlock.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
It looks like the forecast is calling for a whole new cloud. Brought to you by CenturyLink. Get a visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions with CenturyLink, all built on a global, secure, carrier-grade network. And their custom solutions and support models are designed to enhance your efficiency every day of the week. Let their cloud infrastructure blanket you with security. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
Want to cut agency data center costs by 68%? HP ProLiant Gen 8 server blades, powered by the Intel Xeon processor E5-2600 series, solve the problem of costs and complexity with superior efficiencies like unprecedented intelligence that maximizes every hour, watt, and dollar for 64% less operating cost. Intelligent power management that pools and shares power and cooling resources for a 36% reduction in power cost and dramatic reduction of expensive downtime by an average of over 90% compared to hours of yearly downtime with traditional server environments. And only HP Blade System lets you consolidate server, storage, and networking into the same enclosure, simplifying system deployment and management and saving you countless IT hours. The power of HP converged infrastructure is here. To plan your strategy, begin with HP Consulting. Go to hp.com/go/federal for more details. That's hp.com/go/federal.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Talking risky behavior. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. What's your teen doing online? What are their privacy settings? The more parents know and the more they talk to their children about it, the better. A study looking at the behavior of teenage girls online showed that their profile says a lot about them. Dr. Jenny Knoll is a professor of pediatrics at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center.
Parents need to be able to talk to their adolescents in a non-threatening and non-shaming way so that they can keep the lines of communication open about the dangers of high-risk behaviors on the Internet.
Knoll suggests these conversations start earlier because kids jump online at younger ages. Her research showed that parental control devices did nothing, but being involved with a child's online presence proved key. The study in the journal Pediatrics was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Sequestration is here, and federal leaders are facing a perfect storm of public scrutiny, increased pressure to perform, and reduced budgets. And Excellence in Government on May 13th and 14th. They will convene federal leaders, managers, and government performance stakeholders at this free educational event to learn the key tactics needed to succeed in today's environment. Join federal colleagues May 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C. to get the ideas you need now to drive high-performance government. Learn more at excellenceingov.com.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week includes the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Alan Shvatkin and John Desenberg. And John, your second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Departures Leave Gap in OMB Management Team. And it's kind of tumbleweeds over there right now. Obviously there are folks in acting capacities. But we have Sylvia Burwell in confirmed as the OMB director, but she has an acting deputy director for management now with the departure of Jeffrey Zients, and she has an acting deputy director for budget as Brian Deese is still awaiting confirmation by the Senate there. Shelley Metzenbaum has stepped down. There's an acting taking her role, Dustin Brown. Mm-hmm. I can't recall the last time I saw that number of acting people at that high a level at OMB.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it has been 4 years. I don't think it's completely unexpected, but they kind of hung around for a little while longer after the re-election, and then suddenly they both left almost exactly on the same day. I don't know if that's really ideal timing to see Jeffrey Zients and Shelley Metzenbaum leave at the same time. You know, I think there's something we've noticed over the last 12 months, which is, you know, number one, Shelley had a strategy where the Performance Improvement Council and her team would go in and help agencies kind of improve their performance measures and really their use of data and information. And I think what they noticed over time was that agencies weren't all that comfortable having OMB as an advisor and a confidant and a trusted kind of confider about their issues and their problems and their challenges, because, you know, OMB also has a budget side that's examining them and in charge of their money. So I think they started to run into some issues there. And over the last 6 months, I think they stopped making as much progress as they wanted to, right? Because I think the writing was on the wall that people were going to leave. Mm-hmm. And one of the good things that's happened recently is Dustin Brown, who's now acting for Shelley, actually gave us a call at the Performance Institute and asked for more input from performance experts and also the performance community around government. You know, there's a lot of people out there with ideas on improving the use of data and changing the way management approaches information, changing the culture of performance, where it's not such a gotcha game. It's more of a how do we improve, not what did you do wrong. And at our government performance summit on June 10th and 11th, the new head of the Performance Improvement Council, Kevin Donahue, is going to be the keynote. And it's not going to be your standard lecture, standard conference. They are using the event to listen to performance executives from around government. And a lot of this has to do with the series of reports that GAO is issuing on what's happened since Skipper modernization, what's happened since that law passed 2 years ago. And I think that OMB and the Performance Improvement Council is a little concerned. I don't think those GAO reports are going to be 100% positive. I think there are still some corners of the government that look at this as compliance. I think certainly we spoke about during the break, Congress still not using performance information the way we all hoped they would. And so I think they are in a bit of a slog here. There's been a bit of a slowdown in progress. When Shelley came on board, there was a lot of energy. And I think it's just natural that at the end of the four-year term, they're looking for ways to pick it up again. What do the next 4 years mean? And I think you see this probably in every administration.
Do you worry about this much turnover in this shortest period of time, not just at OMB, but at any federal agency? I mean, we actually have a similar situation at VA.
Yeah, the vacancies are a real trouble, particularly in political positions like that, because there is a world of operational difference between political and career professionals. And so those vacancies, the career professionals who step in can do a good job of maintenance, but they certainly don't have the authority and often don't want the authority of the politics, and they don't engage in that. So they really become caretakers, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but that's how they function. Jeff Zients was a little different because he was in a political position. He was in that high-visibility role at OMB, so even though he was an acting director for a long period of time, and he clearly had both the ear of the president and the clout of the position. So that's a little different situation than a vacancy filled, a political vacancy filled by a career.
Mm-hmm. We are seeing the same thing at CMS, and later this afternoon, Carrie Weems, the former acting administrator at CMS, will talk about Marilyn Tavenner, who is, that looks like, about to be confirmed as CMS administrator. She'll be the first permanent administrator that agency's had in forever. And since before Mr. Weems was in that role, we'll talk about some of the things that she'll be able to do with the full faith and credit of the Senate behind her on that. It makes a bigger difference, I think, than a lot of people realize when someone is moved up from the acting role to the permanent job. We don't expect to see that here because, as the GovExec story mentions, and they cite the fact that Jason Miller reported this on last Friday, that Jeffrey Zients was leaving. We don't see actings expected to hold on to these roles permanently, but still, there's a big difference between somebody in the role temporarily and somebody in the role permanently.
Well, and especially the two examples that you've cited, Francis, at CMS, let's just think about CMS. I mean, the Affordable Care Act and what the change, the whole dynamics of what it means to provide health care in this country is completely changing from a fee-based system to an outcome-based system of payment. I mean, the ramifications for states, cities, hospitals, health providers around the country, they're expecting to transform healthcare. And to do that with someone who's acting is just nonsensical and I think impossible in many ways. So when you have huge missions, it's one thing if you're a caretaker for an agency that really is in kind of a static hold position. But if you're in a CMS or if you're even in an OMB and you're expecting to drive government performance and a change in management style, you just can't do that from an acting position.
John Desenberg's second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline, Departures Leave Gap in OMB Management Team. And you can read that and more at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. All the stories from the countdown posted there later today. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week from John Desenberg and Alan Schfotkin on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
What is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services technology innovation strategy? What is HHS doing to make data more accessible? How is HHS using new technologies and innovation to meet its mission? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in every Monday at 11 on Federal News Radio 1500.
At BAE Systems, we always focus on keeping troops safe. One challenge military pilots face, it's called a brownout. When helicopter pilots confront dust storms or fog, the risk of collision is much higher. That's why we created a technology that lets pilots see terrain and obstacles through these conditions. Knowing our work helps to save lives inspires us every day. We'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
Are you a federal employee or government contractor? FederalNewsRadio.com is the best source for news that helps you do your job better. Our news team brings you the latest on federal pay and benefits, technology, defense, retirement, acquisition, and the federal budget as it's happening. FederalNewsRadio.com gives a voice to the federal community. Read and hear interviews with federal leaders, members of Congress, and industry. Find it all at FederalNewsRadio.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our breaking news email alerts.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Shelley Metzenbaum is the former OMB Associate Director for Personnel and Performance.
I think we've really changed the mindset where people treated goals and measurement as something that they needed to do because it was a requirement, to now really using the data to realize a goal is a very powerful and simple and effective shorthand for communicating priorities. It's not punishment, it's about improvement.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week with the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we're up to the top.
Number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Alan Schwatkin, is from federalnewsradio.com, and it continues the theme that we were talking about a moment ago, Alan. Your headline is OMB's Metzenbaum leaves behind an invigorated performance culture. It's Jason Miller's story on Shelley's departure. And we talked about, I want to talk about what Shelley did specifically in just a minute. But we talked about the turnover and the churn there. One of the things that I thought was weird, and GovExec cited it when they mentioned that Jason broke this story last week about Jeff Zients leaving, is I just thought it was a little odd the way that we learned about his departure. Shelley mentioned, I'm leaving. She told a few people, and you know what happens in this town when you tell a few people. Pretty soon everybody knows. And that struck me as standard operating procedure. The Zients situation was a little different. Now, nobody that I know of thought that he was going to stay, and everybody expected that he would get one of the other administration jobs that he was interested in or would move on to something else. It just struck me as weird that his last day was Wednesday, May 1st. We learned about it. Jason learned about it by hearing a tip and then emailing him and getting an auto response that says, as of May 1st, I will no longer be at the Office of Management and Budget. 2 days later, nobody knew or nobody reported it. Nobody said anything for 2 days. I thought that was weird. Jason didn't think it was weird. What did you think?
I don't think it's weird at all. I think at that level of the political appointees, your last minute is your last minute, and you don't decide that.
Right.
So when Zilia was confirmed, the moment she was sworn in, game over. He's no longer acting now. He still had a position.
He still was DDM.
But at that point, I think he was ready to leave. The expectation was that he would be leaving. Whether he gets another position, the administration, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. But I didn't find it weird at all as a process.
Okay.
It took a while to learn about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, out of office on the email, voicemail that said, you know, you can no longer reach me at OMB. But we see that a lot.
And it's not like I expect him to stand on top of EEOB and say, I'm leaving. Attention, I am leaving. But, you know, it just wasn't, I don't know.
Well, Francis,
am I off mark?
No, this builds on another mystery that I've never really discussed with anyone, which was in the news, which was that he overstayed the legal limit on being an acting person. I don't know if you ever saw that in the news.
I don't think I did.
I don't know if you saw that, Alan. There's a statutory limit on how long someone can serve in an acting position, and he greatly overstayed as acting director over there.
Yeah.
So that is another mystery, how they allowed that to occur.
Well, because nobody really thought of it, I guess, and nobody protested it because nobody that had the authority to say anything about it probably cared.
I guess if you noticed very carefully on the memos that he signed after that 6 months had expired, he no longer put acting under his name or something.
That's exactly right. He was signing those memos as the deputy director for management, the position that he was confirmed in. Look, the Vacancies Act was put into place for a reason. It operates in weird ways, but be assured, lots of people watch that, including individuals, because if you overstay, you lose any access to your salary. I mean, you can't get paid. So not only do the agency lawyers look at it, but the government accountability looks at it, the Congress looks at it. So it was not coincidental that his signature on those memos went from acting director back to his original position.
Well, I want to be clear, and I said this when I talked about it with Jason on the air, but I want to say it here. I'm not suggesting that there was anything underhanded going on here at all. I just thought it was a little odd. Just a little different than the way that we're used to gaining this information.
Right.
Not that I think anybody was trying to pull one over on anybody or anything like that. Just kind of a different process than I'm used to.
So my purpose for the story,
where I wanted to go next.
My purpose of the story is twofold. One, to recognize how far both Jeff and Shelley have put the M in management so far within the Office of Management and Budget. Really elevated that management role far above where, over and above where the Bush administration had already started. And some good people on the management side, Clay Johnson and others under the Bush administration. So I'm not knocking prior work. Second concern is, can it stay? Mm-hmm. I mean, OMB as an agency is both incredibly powerful and incredibly small. The budget almost always dominates. And so particularly in the last couple of months where they've gone through a continuing resolution, a full year, at the same time putting together the president's budget and dealing with sequestration, to get any mind share around management has been really incredible and incredibly difficult, and yet they've been able to sustain it. I believe that we'll be able to continue some of that, but my eyes are going to be on how much and how rapidly we can reinvigorate the management side of OMB over the next couple of months. I hope we don't lose ground because of the good people like Jeff Science and Shelley Metzenbaum leaving.
Well, it's the part of this that I think is fascinating, John, is the M part has gotten so robust over the last, I guess now, three presidential terms that I actually had a former OMBer say to me earlier this week, what happened to the B? Where, you know, again, you mentioned in your story, your second most important story, that Brian Deese is waiting to be confirmed as the budget director there, the B part. And all the emphasis and all the juice seems to be on the management side and not as much on the budget side. Well, is that a fair take on that?
I think it's become very popular and people are interested in it for good reason. Management's important. But if you look, the FTE-wise, budget side is still much bigger. I think my lesson that I draw from Shelley's time at OMB is this. Be careful what you wish for, right? They wanted the Government Performance and Results Modernization Act, and they basically, their language ended up in the final law. Congress ended up passing it with some small changes. The president signed it, but once it was signed and became law in January of 2011, OMB at times seemed to me to be a little overwhelmed with all that was in that law, everything they had to do between going to Congress to consult on measures and working on high-performance priority goals and all of the other things that they were doing, and it seemed like they were having a little bit of a hard time digesting it all. They got kind of their wish list, and then it became overwhelming. I think the good news, Alan, is that it is in law now, so it won't go away. I think the possible bad news is it's in law, but what are the results going to be? Is Congress really going to take it seriously? I think we're seeing some mixed signals there. And can OMB really take the law and do good with it? I think that's still a question.
One of the things that Jason Miller gets to in his interview with Shelley Metzenbaum that is the bulk of this piece that you've selected as your most important story of the week is that exact issue of what they've tried to do to bake this in so that it doesn't get undone or it doesn't get reprioritized either by her successor in this administration or by another administration that comes along. Doesn't matter what party, everybody wants to put their own little twist or brand on something, and these things do change, but the techniques and the goals and the ultimate outcomes they want to make sure stay the same. Alan Shvatkin's most important federal news story of the week is federalnewsradio.com's story, OMB's Metzenbaum leaves behind an invigorated performance culture. And you can find it and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. One more left, John Desenberg's most important federal news story of the week next on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Tom, you were supposed to be at the Jones hearing this morning. That bill is important to us.
I was there all morning.
Wait a second. Sally said you picked up your lab results from the doctor this morning.
I did. I got all of my lab results, asked my doctor a question, and ordered two prescription refills. But I never left the hearing.
How did you do that?
Kaiser Permanente.
Hmm.
They send lab results electronically.
Huh.
I can also email my doctor's office and order most prescription refills electronically.
No kidding.
While I was in the Senate hearing, I even made a follow-up appointment for next week at their new care center by Union Station.
Tom, you did all of that from your cell phone?
Yep, from the hearing room.
Huh.
That's why I joined Kaiser Permanente. They're probably the most electronically connected care team in the country. Plus, they have great quality and service ratings. I checked them out on the NCQA website. So relax. I never left the hearing room, and I had it all covered.
I never doubted you for a second, Tom.
Kaiser Permanente, the future of healthcare today. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
This is J.J. Green. The U.S. Army is the main branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. The highest-ranking officer is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The regular Army has 562,000 soldiers. The Army National Guard has 362,000, and the U.S. Army Reserve has 205,000, putting the combined component strength at 1.1 million soldiers. If you have a story about the Army you'd like to share, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com.
We see the hiker. He appears injured.
Every day, the Army and National Guard take to the skies in their newest helicopter, the UH-72A Lakota from EADS North America. Whether for medical evacuation, search and rescue, or emergency response, the Lakota ensures our armed forces complete the mission.
Hiker is secure.
And every Lakota has been delivered on time and on budget.
ETA, 30 minutes.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
The secret to being successful is never slowing down. Your agency's mission doesn't have a pause button. And with CenturyLink as your trusted technology partner, you don't have to slow down. Their visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions are backed by dedicated responsive support. Pause button not included. To learn more about how CenturyLink keeps you up and rolling 24/7, 365, visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov.
PortfolioStat was first introduced by the Office of Management and Budget as a tool for agencies to assess their IT portfolios for duplicative programs, systems, and resources. In March 2013, the OMB released PortfolioStat 2.0, which incorporates best practices, integrates the Federal Data Center Consolidation Initiative, and streamlines agency reporting requirements. Join FCA Bethesda on May 22nd as agency executives take a look at how these new processes will better drive IT management and investments. Register today at fciabethesda.org/maybreakfast.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. And we're at the top of the chart. The number one most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Desenberg of the Performance Institute. It's from Computer World. And the headline is "More Data Isn't Always Better," says Nate Silver. He's the guy with the 538 blog on the New York Times website. And he's written a book called "The Signal and the Noise: Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't." And this is an interesting thing for us to consider, John, because big data, I mean, I say it on this show, it seems like about every 5 seconds. But bigger is not always better. Where have we heard that before?
Yeah, right.
And he's pointing this out in a way that, although this story is not a federal news story per se, is very valuable and important to people that are thinking about this issue in government right now.
Yeah. You know, and first of all, I wanted to thank Francis, you and Alan, for turning this hour into the performance and data hour. I really appreciate it. I feel very welcome here. And by the way, I go out of my way not to use that term, that big D term. I'm not even going to use it.
Big data.
I'm not scared. Believe me, every time I hear it, I feel like turning the channel. It's just overused. But this is very important. And the Performance Institute right now is engaging in a long-term, probably our most academically vetted research study on this topic. We're calling it third dimension performance analysis and reporting. And what that means is, can we tell the probability of a program's success through their measures? And that's what I wanted to point out here. And it goes along with our previous discussion about what OMB has been doing, which is going from collecting and reporting on data to actually using it to accurately predict if a program will or will not succeed. And the question is, which measures are the right measures? What data are you looking for? Because frankly, as Nate Silver points out, we're collecting everything. And I think if, particularly in the federal government, there's a feeling that this is becoming a real burden. Why is it a burden? We're collecting too much. I don't think we're always collecting the right information. Let's scale back. Let's try to figure out what matters and what doesn't matter. There's been studies on this. It's somewhere between 7 to 10 measures in a dashboard are the right number. You go much beyond 15, people start tuning out. And as Shelley Metzenbaum has said, it's about prioritization. So the way I've been explaining it to people is this. When you're playing a hand of cards, you know, based on statistics, and you can see it on TV when they broadcast games like poker and those kind of games, depending on what's in your hand, your odds of winning and losing go up and down. If I discard a certain card, that's going to help me or hurt me. If I pick up a card, that's going to help me or hurt me. What we're trying to figure out here is what are your cards? And how do you know in advance, before the game ends, if we are likely to succeed? I'll give you an example real quickly here. We've been doing work with DHS, and DHS asked us about SBINet, the famous fence, the fence that turned out to only be a 28-mile fence before it kind of failed. Why did they not know it was going to fail? Why were they measuring the wrong things? Were they not paying attention to the right indicators? Was the contractor telling them to measure certain things when they really probably should have been measuring other things? This is what we really want to focus on now, which is understanding the odds and the factors that are important, what's important and what's not.
Your members are all just ankle deep, waist deep in big data. That's the next thing. That's the cybersecurity of 2013, 14, 15, the next wave. What are you hearing about concepts like this, like we have to look at what we're collecting and all of that?
It's at the top of everybody's list. We clearly agree with them that the government collects a lot of information, often the wrong information, and needs to step back and at the beginning, start looking to the end game. If you're in the middle of a game, it's too late to change. It's too late to start figuring out your odds in the middle of that card game. You need to be thinking about that in advance. And too many programs don't think about the measurement and the evaluation till they're well into it. And I think, so I look at dashboards and we've got portfolio stats and tech stats and act stats and how many other stats can we use? We've now become blinded by the amounts of data out there. We need data for analysis, and we need different data for policy making, and I don't think those two are clearly differentiated.
The lesson that I take away from this program is that if I know John is listening, I'm not going to say the word big data anymore, because he's already warned me he's going to turn the channel. And I need to hang on to as many people listening to the program as I possibly can. John Desenberg's most important federal news story of the week is "More Data Isn't Always Better," says Nate Silver. It's from Computer World, and we'll link it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a great federal news countdown. Terrific stories and great input from John Desenberg of the Performance Institute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Alan Shvatkin of the Professional Services Council. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure.
And you can hear this program archived later today along with those stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number two of the program is right around the corner.